From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
For anyone who thought his first week in office would be the most memorable of his presidency, Donald Trump has proved them wrong. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Hugh Hewitt, conservative radio talk show host, is our special guest. So much to cover this week, so let's dive right in. We saw a record protest against the Trump administration's immigration proposals, which they have claimed do not represent a Muslim ban. But last week, he issued an executive order barring citizens from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, and Libya from entering the U.S. for 90 days and put Syrian refugee admissions on hold indefinitely. Now, I think the early sense from the intensity of the protest was that there was widespread outrage about these measures, especially once Republican criticism began to mount from Senator John McCain and others who were critical, if not of the entirety of the measures, then of their execution. But Reuters just released an interesting poll that found 1 in 2 Americans back this ban. A third say it makes them feel more safe. A third say it makes them feel less safe. And a third say it will make no difference. Now, there is obviously division along party lines, but Rich, I was hoping to start with you because of something you've said previously, which is that polls showed people seem to like President Obama, but often didn't like his policies. And there seems to be the opposite occurring with the current commander in chief. Do you think that the new president has more of a mandate for some of these controversial policies than those of us in media gave him credit for? And even the opposition in Congress and some of his his party members in Congress even anticipated.
Yeah, I think this one is about a 50-50 proposition. It's going to strike a lot of people as common sense. And if you look at the face of it and take it on its own terms, it's by no means a radical measure, just a couple months pause in visa admissions from 7 countries, most of which are war-torn or hostile to us, and a couple of which have no central governments whatsoever, is not going to strike most people as radical, nor is the cap on refugees of 50,000 annually. If you look at the number over the last 15 years, it's bounced between about 50 and 100,000 admissions annually, sometimes lower than that, lower than 50,000. So this is, I think, another instance of a completely hysterical and over-the-top reaction to what, if you actually calm down and take a deep breath, is not a radical policy.
I'm sure Katrina 100% agrees with everything you just said.
Well, I was going to say we're here the second week of the Trump presidency, and I think many people are stunned by the speed and the cruelty of the Trump administration's initial executive orders and announcements. I think this is deeply counterproductive, this ban. I'm not even going to get into the moral, cruel, inflammatory nature of it. But it's dangerous. It alienates key allies in the Middle East. It endangers U.S. troops, empowers extremist groups. It lacks any logic and invokes 9/11 while exempting the countries of origin of those hijackers. And I do think
Saudi Arabia. Pakistan and Afghanistan also weren't included,
which surprised
a lot of critics.
Absolutely,
Kelly.
Can you
talk about why that is?
I mean, I think one reason is it's interesting that none of these countries, Trump does not have financial involvement in any of the countries on this list. And I think, you know, we see with the saber rattling about Iran, Saudi Arabia is the source of terrorist threats and dangers, but no, it seems off limits for this administration.
Rich and Hugh, did either one of you want to respond to that criticism, which has not only been wielded by the left?
It's common sense. I think.
I think it's obviously a prudential consideration. If you had such a policy with Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, it would be a major diplomatic crisis. So it's a little bit, the left on the one hand says it's a Muslim ban, and then the other hand says it's not enough of a Muslim ban because you're not covering all Muslim countries. And
it's oftentimes hypocritical.
In the real world, you kind of do what you can and you do what you consider most threatening. And again, several of these countries have actually collapsed. They have no central government. So vetting people who are coming there is inherently problematic.
I do think it is. Hugh is a lawyer. I am not. But we saw enormous protest, as you know, Kelly. I mean, airports were packed with people. 30 cities had protests and a fierce, broad opposition across from Silicon Valley to people in the State Department. But I think it sets an unconstitutional standard, this executive order, by excluding Muslims while giving government officials discretion to admit people of other faiths.
I have been on a book tour for 2 weeks for The Fourth Way. So I have done 30 interviews on 15 different channels, 4 networks. And I am amazed at the disconnect between the media and people that I talk to in everyday life. The signal and the noise problem is huge. Everyone is talking about Gorsuch. They're talking about Iran and being on notice. That made it its way through. And they talk about Trump's temperament and, you know, Arnold jokes at the prayer breakfast. And there are protests about the ban. But it is actually, I think Rich said this early, it's kind of common sense to most people, and it's not unconstitutional. I disagree with that. I don't think there'll be anything struck down except as to legitimate green card holders caught up in the backwash. But it's not actually on the minds of most Americans. They kind of thought this was in place already.
Can I follow up with that, Hugh? Because actually that was the perfect segue to something I did want to ask you specifically, which is there are reports that this actually might not be the last controversial potential immigration executive order from the Trump White House. And specifically, there was a report in The Washington Post this week and a couple of other outlets that there's an executive order being explored that would possibly deport immigrants who are receiving certain forms of public assistance and also require more stringent ways to shut down birth tourism, which is, I know, considered sometimes a pejorative term by the left, but does exist. In fact, where you're based, Hugh, in California, there are a number of maternity, birth tourism, maternity hotels, which I've written about before. And my sense was reading the reaction among progressive publications online, it was sort of framed as here's another wacky, you know, immoral, hostile, angry, crazy Trump policy. My experience talking to plenty of people when I write about birth tourism in particular and public assistance for immigrants is that this is the kind of thing that's considered a no-brainer. So can you talk a bit about whether or not you think those policies will have legs and start to really kind of play into the disconnect between the media bubble you're talking about and people in the rest of America?
I will. I'll preface it by saying you got to keep in mind what President Trump did not do. He did not revoke DACA. And the fourth way
the
is all about
dreamers.
The dreamers. And the fourth way is all about, I think he's going to do a Nixon to China and overhaul immigration in a rather generous fashion after he builds the fence. And I also see there's an alleged executive order on the First Amendment protections for that will drive the left crazy. But I'm not going to go with rumor here because it's such an unexpected White House in the first 2 weeks. Birth tourism, as you say, it's actually a term that we would never use on my PBS affiliate out here. We would always say expectant mothers who find themselves in the United States intentionally.
That's a mouthful.
That's a mouthful.
Okay.
But there are certain words that sort of like the left doesn't refer to churches when they talk about the Johnson Amendment. They refer to houses of worship. There are certain things that I just go along with not
to
give people
in.
It's the professional atheist that do it, Katrina. Last night I heard an interview where the guy said house of worship 18 times. I was ready to throw myself out of the car. Okay. Say churches!
We're all learning about the Johnson Amendment. I think Johnson rammed it through because his opponent ran a nonprofit which kept alleging Johnson was a communist.
That's exactly right. 100% right.
Thank you.
That is 100% right. So I do not think there is a great deal of space between ordinary people and Donald Trump on immigration issues, but provided he does not revoke the Dreamers and provided mass deportation doesn't happen. Yep.
I think the Dreamers, revoking the Dreamers, would unleash. I mean, it's about tearing families apart and, you know, President Obama was not great on this, but the numbers were way high and inflated about Obama's immigration policy. But I think you're having fantasy life, Hugh, if you think post-building a wall, we're going to get to some what we need in this country is a common-sense immigration policy. Common sense has been batted around a lot right now, but there was on order a common-sense immigration policy, which got pushed back, and now we're in this space. I do agree with you about the signal to noise. We had a correspondent in Youngstown, Ohio for a month. You know, people are, you know, finding what they want in this executive order. And a lot of people may not even be listening to Gorsuch. They're just watching sports. They're not paying attention to a lot of this. And if they are, they feel in some parts of this country, Trump is fulfilling campaign promises. Checklist 1, 2, 3.
Well, I hope Hugh is living in a fantasy world when he says that Trump's going to go Nixon on China on immigration. Because one of the critiques I would have of this executive order from last weekend is it's spending a lot of political capital on something that's really a drop mm-hmm. in the bucket. And the big, for those of us who are restrictionists, the big items are getting a mandatory E-Verify system, so it makes it much harder for employers to hire illegal labor, and two, reducing the number of green cards in this country and reducing the overall level of legal immigration. Those are the big enchiladas. And on the E-Verify, I hope the Trump administration is thinking of trading DACA for E-Verify. And it's not just preserving DACA. That thing needs to be done legislatively as a matter of Democratic hygiene. But I hope they're using it as a bargaining chip to say, Democrats, will let these dreamers stay, but you need to help us crack down on employers who are exploiting illegal labor.
Rich, there you go again. Your own Jim Garrity reviewed the fourth way and loved the immigration deal because it brings in Democrats along with the infrastructure to get us our 350-ship Navy, entitlement reform, and tax code reform. Go big, go far, go fast, Rich. And if we have
Don't use my own Jim Garrity against me.
I am. I've weaponized
your
own.
That's not fair.
I've weaponized your own writers. There you go.
We're, as editors, we don't agree with everything we publish.
So we know that the president had his first phone call with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull this week. We also know, according to, well, everyone, it did not go well. They had a dispute over about 1,200 refugees that the U.S. agreed to allow to enter this country under President Obama, who the new president, although the new president kept referring to them as illegal immigrants for some reason. You know, look, John McCain, Senator John McCain later tried to call the Australian ambassador to fix this, for lack of a better term. I'll just toss this out here. Yeah. I'll start with you, Rich. Do you think America's diplomatic relations with our allies can survive 4 years of a Donald Trump presidency?
You know that the cables are going on around every foreign ministry. Do not mention the popular vote when you talk to President Trump, whatever you
Absolutely.
Do on any call.
It's true.
But, you know, obviously you don't want to have an angry phone call with the Australian Prime Minister, one of our great allies. And I was as appalled and amused by this whole episode as everyone else. But then you get down to the policy. Actually, why are we taking refugees that Australia won't take in and is holding in these horrible offshore facilities, and they have to come to the United States? I can see why Donald Trump might sit down and get the briefing before this call and say why.
All right, but you know there are 195 countries in the world. Trump has managed to insult two or more in the last 12 days. How many countries will be our enemies at the end? I'm not that concerned about Australia. I think that's going to work out. I am concerned about the escalating tension with Iran. On the other hand, Trump promised in his campaign he wanted to either rip up the Iran nuclear agreement or make a better deal. But he has three people around him: Flynn, Mattis, Wild Dog, and Pompeo, who are fiercely anti-Iran and really see it as war with Islam. There doesn't seem to be a coherent plan right now, and I think that is very dangerous. And I think that Iran agreement is going to need a lot of protection and fight from Democrats and common sense Republicans.
I'll come back to Iran in a second, but I got to go to the fact that you sent a reporter to my home, Mahoning Valley, Youngstown. I'm from Warren,
yes,
which is next door. If Youngstown gets those 1,000 Australian refugees, they are not going to be happy, Katrina, because this goes to Rich's point. I didn't know about this deal. And I can just see Trump saying, what? Huh? Why? And then saying, no, I don't want them. And then finding out that President Obama has signed an executive order to which he honors deals. He's a deal maker. Developer, he'll honor it, but I can see him getting upset, and I can understand why, because most Americans will say what Rich just said. What the hell are we doing? We gotta leave it there.
Let us know what you think about the president's immigration policies on our Facebook page or our Twitter account at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, a supreme fight is brewing over the future of the nation's highest court. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kelly Goff, columnist for The Daily Beast. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of The National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. And Hugh Hewitt, conservative radio talk show host and author of the new book, The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority, is also with us. This week, the president announced his very first Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, who is currently a federal judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals 10th Circuit. He would fill the vacancy left by Antonin Scalia, and is also a second-generation presidential nominee. His mother, Anne, ran the EPA under President Reagan. So I want to try something a little different and just do a quick round robin. Can each of you answer these two questions quickly, short replies,
No, what? We can't. I'll let you know. We cannot answer them quickly.
It's not in our DNA.
Do you have any fun? Okay. The two questions are, what do you think of him as a nominee? And question two is, how likely is his confirmation? Hugh, can we start with you?
Home run, 100%.
I agree.
I disagree. And the idea that Donald Trump is, quote, pro-worker populist was shredded with the appointment of a guy who would make courts a rubber stamp for big multinationals that imperiled vulnerable community. And his record lacks evidence demonstrating he would vote to check a strong-arming executive president. So I could say a lot more, but you set us to this is my round robin. That's my round robin.
Not quite as short as Rich and Hughes, but that is great. So, Hugh, you mentioned in your recent op-ed for The Post that you believe the change to the Senate rules have ensured that much more conservative and more liberal justices get confirmed as opposed to more moderate justices. Can you explain why you believe that? And you also said that you think Kennedy's going to retire too this year.
I think that Justice Kennedy will much more likely to retire with the appointment of Judge Gorsuch, because not only is it the first time in the history of the Supreme Court that a clerk has served along with the judge for whom he clerked, they're friends, they are close, he's proud, it signals how Trump will go. But back to the filibuster, Harry Reid lowered the confirmation standard to 51 from 60 for all judges except the Supreme Court. The Reid rule can be applied and will be applied to the Supreme Court. What that does is encourage Republicans to send up anyone they want. For example, my good friend John Eastman, who Katrina knows and Rich knows, very conservative, very originalist, Thomas Clerk, would never have gotten through the United States Senate with a 60-vote margin. He'll get through a 50-vote margin. On the other side, when Democrats get the White House back in that dark age is ahead of us at some point, they will send up the Gordon Lews. They will send up the people who couldn't get through before, and they will get through if they have a majority. The 60-vote rule was a guardrail that kept everyone rather in the center. Now, for me, I'm happy if we hold the Senate for 8 to 12 years to stock the bench with originalists, but long term, I know Mitch McConnell wants to rebuild that guardrail, and I'll bet Katrina does as well.
Well, but I mean, the real background here, the backdrop is, you know, the right talks about being borked. At least Robert Bork in 1987 had a hearing on the substance. To be Merrick Garland, is to be denied a chance to even make your case. I think there should be a full hearing, a full vetting of Gorsuch's nomination, but the fight is a real one because he is, as you said, an originalist. And I think, though, it's not just partisan. It's about the issues. Scalia light. It is the case that the second nomination, if Kennedy retires, is another, if he gets through Gorsuch, it's another fierce fight because that truly changes the composition.
Well, Gorsuch is an originalist, one. Two, he's very suspicious of executive overreach and especially executive agencies making rulings of the sort that Katrina right at the moment is excoriating. So if liberals really believe that Donald Trump is a budding authoritarian and they need to throw out the rule book and act and think anew because of this unique threat to our republic, they should be all about confirming this constitutionalist. But they're not, because they're playing by all the same rules, just a little more intensely, and they really care about judges who will impose a progressive social agenda from the High Court.
Wait a minute, Rich. Is gutting protections for clean air, clean water, safe food and medicine, for workers' rights, for consumers, is that like a left agenda without being rooted in people's rights?
He has a textualist agenda just the way Scalia did. And there's actually a book that's come out. The author wrote a Washington Post op-ed about this the other day about Scalia's quote-unquote liberal opinions. Now, Scalia wasn't a liberal, but he interpreted the law and the Constitution as he found it, which led to liberal outcome. Gorsuch is a judge very much in that tradition.
So Rich is referring, for instance, to
let me go three quick points. Justice Scalia is less conservative than Judge Gorsuch on free exercise. He authored an opinion in 1990, Employment Division versus Smith, which people like me, free exercise absolutists, find still problematic. Judge Gorsuch has twice ruled for free exercise clause. But Katrina, his dog whistle to you last night or two nights ago was he brought up the fact this is not just the Scalia seat, it's the Robert Jackson seat. And when FDR interned wrongly under the 14th Amendment, Japanese Americans, Robert Jackson spoke out against it. When Harry Truman wrongly seized the steel mills, Robert Jackson dissented against that and turned, or actually was in the majority in turning down President Truman's steel seizure. And so what Rich just said is what you ought to focus on if you're really worried about an authoritarian president. You really ought to love Gorsuch.
Can I ask a quick, hop in here to ask a quick question, though? As an African-American woman, I always wonder why the celebration of strict interpreters of the Constitution when it had to be fixed so that I could vote.
Can I answer it as a professor? Because I often teach African-American students.
I'd love for you to.
It's because the 14th
Amendment. And as a woman.
Okay, and the 14th Amendment and the right to vote were passed in order to provide full rights to African Americans and women, and then promptly not applied by the Supreme Court, gutted in the slaughterhouse cases in Plessy v. Ferguson. It was judges who undid the protections that were designed for those newly freed slaves and for people of color and for gender after the amendment, allowing them equal right to
vote. But could I pick up, though, we've all been having this discussion about originalist. Linda Greenhouse of the New York Times had a very interesting column the other day in search of what is this mainstream. I mean, you think about how a Supreme Court majority would invoke the Constitution to cut the heart out of the Voting Rights Act of 65. That might have been dismissed out of hand two decades ago, Hugh. And I think, you know, Bork's insistence that the Constitution must be interpreted in light of the original understanding of its authors, of Hugh Gorsuch, is certainly said to share, was a fringe notion in 1987. So I think a larger fight is that gravitational political pull of what the social consensus is, the political mobilization around a mainstream, because it has certainly moved in directions that may preclude what you were saying earlier, quoting Jackson.
There's an entire chapter in the Fourth Way about why LGBTQ people should not worry about Obergefell being overturned because of Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts' concurrence in Citizens United about what you do overturn and what you don't overturn. You have to overturn Plessy v. Ferguson, where judges upheld separate but equal, Kelly, but you have to leave alone decisions like Obergefell where people have relied upon them. You don't want judges of the left who feel like they're in charge, putting their progressive view of the world on charge. You want judges who will leave alone what ought to be left alone and change the wrongs that are real.
Let us know what you think about the president's Supreme Court and cabinet picks on our Facebook page or our Twitter account at LRCKCRW. There is another bruising battle that the Trump administration is facing in Betsy DeVos. Really quickly, Katrina, can you tell me what the left's primary critiques of her are?
That she is more interested in gutting than reviving good public education in this country. I mean, it has to do with her support of charters, which used to have a more eclectic, inclusive meaning, and they've basically now become stalking horses for trying to gut public education. I think we do need reforms. We need better public education, but not the road or route she is taking. That's my, I think, the main concern.
So it was announced that two Republican senators, yeah, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, have broken ranks to vote against her, which means it's possible the vice president might have to cast a tie vote on her nomination, which is not something that happens often. But I want to ask a follow-up. You know, I've written about charter schools for years, and poll after poll after poll shows that they are extremely popular among Black parents, or actually becoming more popular. Cornell Belter, the African-American pollster who formerly worked for the Democratic National Committee, released a study that found that almost 80% of Black parents really like vouchers and over 70% really like charter schools. Do you think that the Democratic Party at some point is going to have to confront the growing gulf on educational policy between the often well-to-do white liberals who run the party and the working class Black parents comprise the base?
But with all due respect, I think you're polarizing the framework more than is actually the case. And in experiment after test, the charter schools have often been shown not to increase test scores, not to be of greater value. You can't deny parents a right to send their kids where they want to go. And I think Randy Weingarten, for example, has put forth a more inclusive program. As long as teachers are valued and it's not the kind of what we've seen in New York with Eva Moskowitz and the success academies, that has not been a strong picture of accountability and inclusion.
But again, in terms of messaging, there seems to be a disconnect.
There has to be, I think, some rethinking about how you message. Absolutely. Not just message, but how you return to the ability to have charter schools that were also accountable, that had high quality teachers and unions involved, but not drawing or driving them down. Charters used to be different a decade or more ago. They've become much more the stalking horses for gutting public education.
Of course, children should have choices. Parents should have choices, and you need private options. You need charter schools. And it's true, a lot of charter schools aren't great and they're flawed. But this has come up in the DeVos debate where people said, oh, the Detroit charter schools are worse than the public schools, when all the evidence is exactly the opposite. They're not great, but they are better on almost every other metric than the public schools. And even when charters perform just as poorly as our rotten public schools, parents think they're safer and more secure environments for their children. And that alone, I think, should be a reason why we have these options.
I'm the product of Catholic schools, and now they thrive in Philadelphia under Archbishop Chaput and in L.A. under Archbishop Gomez. I'm on the board of Great Hearts Public Charter in Arizona. Extraordinary success, long waiting list. It's a public charter system. The Hillsdale private charter schools are thriving, long charter school list. So, Katrina, I think your worries are overstated. I think most of the opposition to Voss, and she will be confirmed, is primarily teachers' union worried about their union dues, bottom line.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
There are many ways to deal with speech that you don't like. You can ignore it, you can debate it, you can write critically about it, but you can't riot over it. Although for an element of the left in the Trump years, this seems to be now becoming the go-to method of dealing with so-called alt-right speakers on campus. Someone should reacquaint these hooligans with what it means to live in a free society.
Katrina Vandenhuvel.
This week, The Nation endorsed Keith Ellison for chair of the Democratic National Committee in the belief that Ellison will address the party's and the nation's crisis by aligning Democrats more closely with movements for social and economic justice. And it is that inside-outside connection that we believe will strengthen not only immediate resistance to the Trump administration, but a rebuilding of the Democratic Party and its progressive base.
Hugh Hewitt, what's on your mind?
Grumbling erupted this week when Leader Mitch McConnell summoned the Senate to work at 6:30 a.m. And it erupted from the Fourth Estate, complaining that they had to be on the Hill at 6:30 in the morning. And I speak on behalf of everyone who is up and at work at 6 a.m. every day, or if I'm on the West Coast at 3 a.m. every day, that this is nonsense. Congress doesn't work hard. Journalists don't work hard. I see people working all night long at donut shops. I see people working all night long at hospital emergency rooms. I do not care. I hope Mitch McConnell keeps the session going until the job is done, the confirmations are done. And if I hear a journalist complaining about having to go to work at 6:30 again in the morning, I want to take him on a tour of L.A. in the middle of the night. People work around the clock.
It's Black History Month, and I want to give a shout out to the Oscars, who have the most diverse nominee slate in history. And I also want to congratulate Emema Umana, whose name I hope I said correctly, and who recently became the first Black female president in the history of Harvard Law Review. But I also want to give a shout out to those who believe we don't need Black History Month. I'm willing to make a deal. I'll support getting rid of Black History Month if you support authorizing the Department of Ed to recall every history textbook so they can be rewritten to include Black history. For instance, most people don't know Black women were crucial to the success of NASA's early years. At least they didn't know until the film Hidden Figures. And until 10 years ago, it wasn't known Thomas Jefferson produced children with a slave he raped, beginning at the age of 14. So until our books are all up to date, I will continue supporting Black History Month. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhuvel, and Hugh Hewitt. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskind is our production assistant. And I'm your host, Kelly Goff. Thank you for joining us. Tune in next week when Josh Barrow is back for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.